today, Co-Chairman Larson, and I think Co-Chairman Eileen McLean will be here later as soon as she can. Today, we're going to hear from the Department of Revenue, Commissioner Rex Winkle, and Dr. Logsdon regarding the price of oil and the projections for the price of oil. And we'll see what they have to say, and they'll be available for questions afterwards. If there's any other senators or representatives in the audience, please feel free to join us at the table if seats are available, if you care to. I see Representative Davies and Carney and Willis there. If you want to join us, please be welcome. So, Commissioner Rex Winkle and Dr. Logsdon, would you like to join us?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the body. I'm Darrell Rexmichael, Commissioner, Department of Revenue, and with me is Dr. Charles Logsdon. We call him Chuck, though. We don't call him Doctor because sometimes we think his reception is not good. we're here to give you...
I thought that might help if I...
Pardon me?
I thought that might help if I addressed him as Dr. Logsdon.
But it does help a little bit. It adds a little prestige, I guess. You know, you should have a certain amount of knowledge. Sometimes knowledge is dangerous, maybe. Anyway, we'd just like to give you an update on where we are with our revenue projections. I think it's important to remember that when we look at where we are today with oil prices, the chart moves up and down. And you probably don't have a daily chart, but we are sending everyone a copy of this chart. At least you should be receiving it. If not, please let us know. And we also do an executive update on a monthly basis and a revenue news on a monthly basis. And if you're not getting those, you should be, so please let us know also. If you're not, we'd be happy to get you on that list. Oil revenues still account for about 85% of the total state general fund unrestricted revenues. The oil prices right now are about their lowest point since what was known as the crash of 1986. I think it's kind of interesting to look at that. In July of 86, the average Gulf and West Coast barrel. And by the way, there was about a 50-50 split of the oil going to the Gulf and to the West Coast in 1986. But that average was $9.72. And if we take that $9.72 or so and bring it forward into 1993 dollars, we get all the way up to $12.13. On December 17th, we're about at the lowest point of the price for oil so far this year. And the West Coast was down to $9.94, and the Gulf Coast was at $11.68. And so if we take an average that, about 85% of oil is now going to the West Coast and about 15% to the Gulf Coast. And if we would average the December price, it's $10.54. Now that $10.54 is less than the 1986 price brought forward into 1993 dollars of $12.13. So we really are lower than where we were in 1986 or 1987. The spread is something that's interesting also. The spread at the low point there in December was $1.74 a barrel between the West Coast and the Gulf Coast. In going back and looking at the price sheet, you can see that information on here because we give it on the backside. We give some information. If you go back and if you were to look at September 30th, 1994, you don't have that one on yours because we don't go back that far. But I just went back and looked at September 30th of 94, and the spread on that particular date was about the lowest it's been in a long time, and that was only 29 cents. And the spread has fluctuated substantially over time. And also the spread between our ANS price and the West Texas Intermediate has also fluctuated over time. And it's significantly discouraging that the spread between Gulf and West Coast is so significant right now. It's really a good indication of the apparent glut of oil on the West Coast markets, which is further deteriorating our price here in Alaska. And a substantial amount of revenue to us, and that's why the export ban, I believe, is so important to the state of Alaska. And so the governor is working hard to try to get that ban lifted. I think a lot of us here in the state are also. That's a brief overview, and with that, I'll turn it over to Chuck to give you some more specifics.
Okay. Yeah, for the record, this is Charles Logston, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I wanted to talk today. I've sort of broken my presentation into a discussion a little bit about where we are in fiscal 94 and where we expect to be in fiscal 95. That's kind of what I planned on concentrating on. And you have a handout in front of you that the front of it is the what the commissioner has referred to as our executive update. And we put this out every month to give you an idea of where we are in the current fiscal year. And right now, we're not doing so well as a result of the low oil prices that that the commissioner spoke of. In fact, oil prices have just been incredibly low. Right, I guess last spring, when we put together our spring forecast, oil prices were in pretty good shape. It was over $18 a barrel. It looked like the kind of global expansion that everyone thought would follow the wake of the fall of communism and the rise of the market economy throughout the world. It looked like there was a good chance that that would start kicking in. I think most people felt that we're going to need a lot more oil from OPEC as a result of that economic recovery. In fact, I would say that the advisors to OPEC suggested that they're going to need to produce 26, 27 million barrels a day by the fourth quarter, by most extrapolations. And that would, there was a fairly good consensus that that was what the future looked like. So we settled on a number of $18.38 a barrel for that mid-case scenario, which would have brought in for fiscal 94 $2.3 billion. Well, not long after the forecast hit the street, a number of things began happening, which were indicative of what was to be the case for the start of fiscal 94. When OPEC met in June, they took a look at the market. They couldn't decide what to do. Kuwait announced that they were, by golly, not going to sign the agreement. They weren't going to produce at the quota that that OPEC had given them. And the market immediately began falling. Most people who were watching the market, including those playing the futures market, continued to think that the price of oil was going to go up, however. And futures prices continued to be higher for further out delivery months than in close months. But the price began to deteriorate. And a lot of people thought, well, it's Iraq. Well, this situation of a mildly downward drifting price continued throughout the summer, and September, analysts were talking about the Iraqi risk premium that the market was capitalizing this sort of risk that Iraq was going to be back in the market and giving it about a $2 a barrel weight, and so you began to see people factoring that not only into their forecasts of the third and fourth quarter price of oil, but it also began to show up on the spot market, and people wanted to sell, not buy. And I think it would be accurate to state that the numbers that were coming in from the people who track the barrels, and that would be a number, there are a number of entities that do that, continued to show that the market was not necessarily that glutted, that it was maybe a little bit too much oil was being produced, but what was happening is that every time the Iraqi ambassador would arrive in New York to sit down and discuss the provisions for lifting the embargo, oil prices would take another drop. Well, this sort of soft market continued through November, and about the time we sat down to do our fall forecast, and we did our fall forecast, and what came out of that was a lot lower oil price projections. We were dealing with what we felt was it was becoming very clear that OPEC was not going to be looking at being able to produce 26 million barrels a day or so in the fourth quarter, and we adjusted downward. So we went from a mid-case scenario of 2.3 million billion, which was our spring mid-case, to a fall mid-scenario of 2.16 billion, and we were assuming something around $16 a barrel oil. We also, our low scenario that we came forward with was a $15 oil price for 94 and a drop to 1.984. So where did that put us? Well, that put us approximately 320 million below the spring target for the low case. So in this recent handout, that I've, the executive update, well, let me just fill you in what happened subsequently. The fall forecast hit the street, and OPEC meets about 2 weeks later, and they can't decide what to do. Rather than cutting production, they raised their quota. So they raised their quota. Well, really, all they did was they decided, well, we're going to get credibility. We're producing 24.7 million barrels a day, so we'll raise our quota up to 24.5. That'll legitimize our production. So at least we won't be a laughingstock, you know, saying that, well, our quota is 22, but we're producing 24.5. Well, that was not what the market wanted to hear. There really was and are, to this right now, too many barrels of oil on the market. And a lot of it stems from the people advising OPEC and OPEC themselves thinking that this big jump in demand was going to materialize, and so they felt they could bite the bullet. Well, right now the price of oil continues to exist at around, I suppose today it's, I think, somewhere around $10 to $12 a barrel, depending on point of delivery. Well, let's walk through a couple of the handouts here. As I mentioned, on the second page of your handout, laid out for you our fiscal 95 number. Talk a little bit about fiscal 94. Oh, before I leave fiscal 94, I just wanted to say if you take the futures market and do our market update, which is on the front page, it's called the market forecast. Right now, we're looking at $1.77 billion. What that projection is it's essentially taking what we have in our back pocket right now for the oil we've produced and sold, or collected taxes and royalties on, plugged in spot prices and production through December, and then valued our anticipated production for the rest of the year as though we sold it all on the futures market. I can tell you if this $1.77 billion comes in the door, this will establish a new low water mark for general fund unrestricted revenues actually since fiscal 79. So the kind of oil prices that we're facing today, that's the kind of revenue scenario that we're looking at for fiscal 94. But let's move on now to fiscal 95, which is on the second page. Now, I assume that everyone probably has a copy of our forecast document, and as usual, we've laid out our scenarios, and we're making some assumptions about consumption of oil and what happens in the non-OPEC countries, and we try to, based on those projections, we sort of come up with, well, how much OPEC oil is the world going to need? And in our low scenario for fiscal 95, we've targeted that at a $15 a barrel price, and we're looking at OPEC's actual market share remaining about what it was this year, somewhere below 25 million barrels a day.
Chuck, are you referring to this page?
Yeah, the scenarios follow this page too. That's exactly right. I'm looking at page 3, 4, and 5, which I won't go through all the assumptions for each of the scenarios, but I wanted to sort of give you a flavor for what the low price scenario was all about.
Representative Martin has a...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm concerned, Chuck, right now. Well, first, I always accuse you of being the eternal optimist, and you're trying to help us, but today's oil price is down on this graph here, page 2 you gave us, down to 10.45, and I'm wondering why you don't begin with that. It looks like you're too high to begin with, and then you're going to end up the fiscal year with about just under 15 a barrel. And I'm afraid, from my point of view, that's too optimistic.
Let's hold questions, Terry, unless you've got a question on his how he's going here.
Just talking about OPEC, there's other players in the market, and that's where our problems are.
Right. That is part. I realize the easy thing to do is to point the finger at OPEC, and but you know, after all, they are the organization which is set up and specifically do try to target a price of, I think their goal is $20 a barrel. But non-OPEC production is an important part of it. That's why we make assumptions about what we think is going to happen in non-OPEC when we develop our assumptions about how much oil OPEC will need to produce to keep the market in balance. to address the issue of the price, let's go back to this page two. And okay, if let's starting at the bottom, okay, with what we call the market forecast of 1.8 billion. What we did there is somewhat similar to what I did for the fiscal 94. What if we took our anticipated production during fiscal 95 and went out today and we sold it all on the futures market? How much money would we get for it? That's basically what that number represents. As you can see, compare that number with the low scenario. We can't quite lock in the low scenario on the futures market. I mean, we can't quite sell all that anticipated production and lock in what we would expect under $15 a barrel. However, I think one thing that I realize that you have to understand that the futures market is simply a reflection of today's cash market with some either premium or discount over today's sales, depending on how the professional speculators feel the market will go in the future. So it changes every day. I guarantee you that number would change quite a bit every day. When we're looking at $15 oil, we're looking at more fundamental things. We're looking at trying to assess how many barrels is it going to take, and if there's any kind of global economic growth, even if the world economy grows only marginally, there will be an increase in the number of barrels of oil consumed, especially at the low prices we have. The longer prices stay low, the more people are encouraged to consume oil, the more people are encouraged to burn oil for some uses that they might not do. I mean, you might start running oil, residual fuel oil, under your burner tip instead of natural gas even. I mean, there's fuel switching that can occur. So we do expect the demand of oil to grow. So I would say that I believe that the futures market projection actually underpins to a certain extent our low scenario. And I believe at this stage, knowing nothing else, that the low scenario probably represents a fairly decent approach to evaluating the fiscal 95. However, a lot could change. So let's take a look at some of the, go to like page five, I guess, page six.
I might add the other thing that when we look at the numbers, when we take the futures market, it is a WTI futures, and we have backed that off by $3 a barrel to arrive at the ANS average price, and that $3 may or may not
be a good
number. I mean, right now it's been averaging a little over $3, but in other years it's averaged under $3 and sometimes well over $3. So it is an approximation. And the other thing that we need to keep in mind in that market forecast, it does include, as we've noted in the executive update, $135 million of these settlement that we've received, that we've deposited into the general fund, that the judge has ruled should be in the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. So you can't just take a look at it and say, well, the market forecast is looking at $13.25 a barrel, and our low-case scenario was $16.03, and so therefore there should be some larger number difference, and that's because there's some other numbers that are factored into this, one of being the settlements that we've received that have been deposited into the general fund. And we do note that on the executive update. We pointed that out in here just so the reader will know that we've included that. It's right down at the very bottom sentence here on the first page.
Right. I guess to get away from the revenues, more to the price of oil that we use to do this, it's like the futures market right now, we could lock in at $14 oil for ANS as opposed to like the $15 that is used in the low scenario. But to give you a perspective on oil prices, it's often handy to look at the history, and that's what page 6 does. We've converted the Saudi light oil price into 1992 dollars here, and it's a time series or a graph of the prices since 1970. And I think you can see that in a way we're still sort of coming off of a very big price run-up that occurred in the early 70s and then later in 79 with the Iranian Revolution. And we're still, the market in a long-term sense is still sort of coming down off that. However, if you look at, say, 1986 at the bottom of the crash, I think you'd also note that in a way we seem to be in that, this, you notice it's almost like a cyclical pattern. I know Scott Goldsmith has referred to this as the mindless sine curve. I don't know how mindless it is, but we've sort of oscillated between $15 and $20 a barrel, although you can see the spike there. We went quite a bit above $20 in in 1990 with the invasion of Iraq. But in a long-term sense, I would it still appears that for a more longer-term perspective, and I'm talking about something like 18 months to 5 years, we still may be in this $15 to $20 area. Now, a lot of analysts have been talking about whether or not we're looking at a new trading range. But before I talk a little bit about that, let's look at the next graph, which a lot of people like the concept of the five-year average. And conveniently, the five-year average sort of puts us into this sort of post-86 market for oil, where the what they call the market paradigm has characterized oil. Oil has become like a commodity. It's traded globally. They talk about virtual barrels and the cyber network of trading, because you can buy and sell oil at your computer screen 24 hours a day. You just follow the market around the world, Singapore, London, NYMEX, New York, and you can do that. So in that environment, this is the environment we've been in. This is the environment of $15 to $20 oil. This is also the recent environment of $10 to $13 oil. But looking at the last five-year average, you can see that looking at it in $92 terms, you can take the spike in, you can take it out. With the spike, is the first bar, it's averaged $18.50. Without the spike, $17.35. The mid scenario for the spring 93 forecast was $18.38. That falls essentially relatively close to that five-year average. However, the other one shows you where December spot is, and it says 10.57 here. I think we said 10.54 before, but a lot depends on the data source. But as you can see, we're in an area where we haven't been since 86. So I guess the fair question to ask is what happened and why are we there? The next graph is...
Well, also on the schedule, okay. It is a $19.92 dollars, and if we would roll that forward a couple more years into today's dollars, that 17.35 would probably be above that 18.38, or at least pretty close to it.
The next graph is just meant to show you the sort of the cataclysmic fall that occurred last fall, really, shortly after the fall forecast, as a matter of fact. Price began going in the tank, and it's gone down over $5 a barrel from the end of October into December. We seem to have achieved perhaps a new trading range there. I don't know. Let's go back up a little bit and look at the table on page 9. When I began my remarks, I talked about this sort of planning for a boost in how much oil OPEC was going to need to produce, and sort of how there was a consensus among OPEC planners themselves that they were banking on having to produce more oil. And you can see, what you have on this graph, the dotted lines are the OPEC production versus their quota. But you can see, I struck a trend line through the 91-92 data. You can see that the amount of oil that OPEC was selling every year was definitely on the upswing. And I think that's really what happened. People started projecting that trend. But as you can see, in the latter part of 93, starting in mid-year, OPEC wasn't able to stay on that trend line. Well, what happened? Well, I think a lot of people fail to appreciate just the fact that the global economy was relatively stagnant, and almost entirely due to the economic recession that continued in Europe and in Japan. And secondly, as Representative Martin suggested, non-OPEC production has done rather well this year, especially from the North Sea, plus Alaska. Starting in October, we suddenly put another 120,000 barrels a day or so into the pipeline when they opened up Point McIntyre and commissioned the gas handling expansion project on the slope. But there are discoveries that began to be developed in other parts of the world as well. So OPEC production was up a little bit. Russian exports for hard currency remained constant, in fact, increased somewhat. It all added up to the fact that OPEC, during the summer, probably overproduced the market by a moderate amount, and inventories built. Well, unfortunately, in a market that is finally balanced as the crude oil market, one where you have these people who are on the network, and they're buying and selling paper barrels. If you have a few, just a very few too many barrels, it makes them very nervous and very skittish about oil prices. And in that environment, all it takes is a trip by the Iraqi ambassador to the UN, and a few people making noises like they're going to work to lift the embargo on Iraq, for the traders to get real nervous and start selling oil. At the same time, the guys that are watching, when the prices are low like that during the summer, what would a refiner do? Well, he's probably, hey, what a great time to pick up some cheap oil. So as long as when they start buying up, inventories there went up, and the traders go, wow, inventories are way high. Well, that's because people were buying it and putting it into inventory. So there was some misreads, I believe, to a certain extent, by the people who weren't actually playing the wet market, who were playing the paper market. Well, this is somewhat theoretical, but I think when you add all this stuff up, we got an environment that was set up basically in which a few too many barrels and enough of these psychological sort of events shocking the market every once in a while to send oil prices down. And when OPEC met and did not cut in November, that's how we got to where we are at $10 a barrel. Okay, well, what next? I guess that's the question that probably everybody has. And I don't have any more charts. I don't have the magic chart to explain that, but I take a stab at it for you. Right now, there's a real division amongst the analysts who watch this stuff. I would say that of the information that we receive from the pundits, about half of the guys out there are saying that there's a new trading range. We're in a new trading range for the next maybe a year. And that trading range is $10 to $13 a barrel for Alaska quality oil. And the reason is number one, that OPEC is pursuing a market share type policy that's not going to do anything to support prices. That they'll continue to let the paper market dictate where the price is going to go. The non-OPEC countries are not going to cooperate because at low oil prices, they're under even greater pressure to produce absolutely every barrel they can. So what's it going to take to bust out of the trading range? This 13 to, or I call actually 11 to 15 is the number I put on it. How long would it take? Well, I think OPEC can continue to do what they're doing, and I believe that economic growth will kick in. I mean, all these trade agreements, the GATT, the NAFTA, the continuing marketization of the Eastern European economies, is plus a recovery in Germany and in Europe and Japan eventually will pick up again. There's going to be a lot of oil needed when that recovery kicks in. And as the longer oil prices stay down, as I said earlier, it causes a lot of things to happen which lead to higher prices on both the supply and the demand side. People go down and they decide to go for the Suburban, not the Subaru. You substitute oil for other fuels at the margin, residual fuel oil. Oil companies invest in other things other than looking for and producing oil in frontier areas. All those sorts of things will lead to less production outside of OPEC, more consumption, which means that the world economy goes back to OPEC wanting more oil. When that situation happens, you get these, if it lasts long enough, you can get these big bursts like we had in 73 and 79. So I think OPEC can play this game. The Saudis really are probably the key player because they have so many discretionary barrels. But eventually the economic growth will put the cartel back in the driver's seat. Unfortunately, how long would that take? I don't know. I believe that if OPEC gets together in March and does the two of the following things, that you would see oil prices move back up into that $15 to $18 range. Number one, they need a credible plan for dealing with Iraq. They need to have an agreed-upon quota system that includes Iraq. Okay? And number two, they need to talk seriously about getting away from this sort of market share policy in which they meet or beat the competition to retain a fixed number of barrel sales. They need a system that would attempt to prorate in a fair fashion the production, and they need to take some barrels off the market. That's what they're going to have to do. As far as on the oil production side of our revenue equation, let's see. Did I have a production chart? Yeah, that's the last table for you on page 10. It shows you. I mentioned the nice little uptick we had into the pipeline when they commissioned Point McIntyre, brought it online. Took us up from 1.5 million of barrels a day in the pipeline up to, on some days, 1.75. We anticipate that sort of thing is going to help us out quite a bit in 95. We expect to produce more oil. We expect to put more oil into the pipeline in 95 than we did in 94. That's basically Point Mac plus Prudhoe Bay, GHX2, plus later this year, we expect Nyakuk to come online. So that will also help us. Now, Nyakuk probably won't be putting another 100,000 barrels a day. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe they're talking about rates of 20,000 a day or so. So that's some good news. That production side is going to help us out in fiscal 95. On the other hand, I'm not able to tell you that we've replaced all the reserves up on the slope. We're still looking at a longer-term decline rate of about 5% a year on the slope. So that's gradual. That's gradual enough, I think, that we have time to deal with our depleting reserve base as far as royalties and taxes go. And I would just mention the only thing I know about Cascade, which BP announced here a couple days ago, is what I've read in the paper, but it sounds like it also is definitely developable, and that it will be contributing some barrels as well. Probably a Nyakuk size field is the word I've heard, but I really don't know anything more than what has appeared in the media. That really concludes my presentation, so I guess I would be available for questions if you had it.
Senator Pearson and Representative Grusendorf.
Thank you. Chuck, I heard Dr. Sobrato speak in early November, I guess, right before the vast fall in prices. And after OPEC brought their quota up to meet what their production was, as you stated, he, and I know he's done it since, publicly pointed at North Sea production and Colombian production and the Russian production being, or the Russian sales being higher than, exports being higher than we expected as being the reason for the fall in prices. He's also retiring from his position this summer, I think in July. And as I understand it, they go alphabetically, and Iran is the next country alphabetically after Indonesia in order to take over OPEC. Do you think the markets are at all yet responding to that? And what do you expect to have happen if indeed we suddenly find Iran having the new Secretary General of OPEC?
Senator Pierce, yeah, I actually the position that the Dr. Sobrato holds, and that would go to someone else, is more like a diplomatic position than it is a policy making position. So I believe that the requirements of that position are to sell OPEC to the world, as it were. And I believe that it should be a neutral effect on the market. But who knows what people out there buying and selling paper barrels might think of that if an Iranian person became the president. But I don't have any way of assessing really any price effects.
It just seems like Dr. Sobrato has been such a stabilizing influence.
Yes, that's exactly right. He's the perfect person for the position because of that. Exactly.
Internal politics within OPEC itself, I would imagine anyone from Iran would not be quite as stabilizing, no matter who they were and how diplomatic.
Right. It could be. One theory is that the reason that the Saudis are content to bite the bullet, because they're suffering financially along with everyone else when oil prices are at $10 a barrel, is that it hurts their enemies worse than it hurts them. And certainly the Saudi royal family is concerned about the existence of hostile neighbors, and Iran is one of them.
Representative Grusendorf.
Yeah, Dr. Logsdon, I've listened very carefully to you and can tell that my background is very different than yours. And in this case, I think as a forecaster, your views are very narrow in coming up with your pricing. When you said that with the fall of communism, that you expected that the economy would grow, which may be true, but not necessarily the consumption of oil. And with my understanding over the years, when you're talking about a industrial war machine, petroleum, oil, and lubricant needed for its operations, that once that consumption be not that productive from your point of view in the private sector of economic growth, there's nothing that can replace that. Now, did the forecasters in any way take that into consideration that the defense, if the defense of the any nation in this world is not gearing its consumption of petroleum and oil and lubricant for defense, that the price is going to go down, that there is going to be a surplus? Well, yeah, it's just plain common sense. And also knowing that the Soviet Union, and we had this discussion before, I don't know if it was here or over in the other body, in dealing with the oil from the Russia and the old Soviet Union going on to the market, that there would be problems. And everything that you've said is always talking about economic growth, which is good for you probably as an economist, but when you're talking about actual consumption, you're usually, unfortunately, talking about things that are not terribly productive, but at the same time employ a lot of people and consume a lot of petroleum products. And I think that's where people have misunderstood that when you have a dismantling of a major political thing, the price is going to go down.
Well, yeah, Representative Grusendorf, as usual, right, it's on the one hand, on the other. You have supply side effects and you have the consumption side effects. I think, first of all, we know that if they can attract foreign capital, we know that the Russian central planned system for developing their oil resource high-graded because they were under pressure to meet production targets, so the guys who had to meet the production targets, they didn't care. They went in and over-drilled, and they couldn't get enough money to use proper development techniques in terms of what we would think is taking out the milk instead of just the cream. And if they can attract, as the market opens up over there and foreign capital comes in, there's a lot of resource that can be developed. What does that mean? More oil? If they do eventually get that thing kicked in, it could very well, on the supply side, have this kind of depressing effect on price.
Buxton, all I am saying is that when you're calculating and forecasting, please consider the variable of the amount of oil that is consumed in the name of defense.
Right. And
economic growth in the private sector is not going to even come close to that type of demand. And when that Soviet Union and the fall of communism, you say, goes, there is going to be a surplus for a long time.
Well, there's a transition there. And I would be the last to say that overnight, I tend to agree that the disruption effect has been underestimated by most people that do this, that in fact...
Please don't take me wrong. I don't will it upon all of us that we have, the massive defensive structures. But I'm just saying, in your forecasting, you got to consider it.
Well, I got to believe if they learned about Visa cards and, high consumption economy that, we could probably sell a lot of oil over there if they were all driving in Suburbans and whatever, It's just a matter of you get the engines... I'm not trying to minimize your question either, because oil, the whole question of how much, what is oil as a part of the energy market basket, and how does that relate to the structure of economy, is a legitimate question. I wish I had the resources to try to make an assessment of that, but I would say that most people who are following this are. I think they've underestimated the costs of the transition from the focusing all your resources in defense and military and trying to redeploy, beat the swords into plowshares. And in that transition, that economy is in a world of hurt, and they're a supply side factor to the market now, not a consumer side, as you rightly point out. And we have The data coming out of Russia has tended to obscure a lot of underlying trends, and I think it may be a reason why people overshot, for instance, this year. It could very well be.
Senator Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. One on back, also on Russia. It seems the articles that I was seeing in the fall were saying that Russian exports were going to be down because the production was collapsing even faster than the economy was collapsing. So, you know, I think you said they were up. So
yes.
That's something that was unexpected by the markets as well.
Yes.
Okay. The other question, I guess the broader question that I had was on your statement that about half of the traders or pundits were forecasting a range of $11 to $15 a barrel. Are there people out there who are looking at, say, on something like your mid-scenario, that the price would go to something like $26 or $27 a barrel? Because if you look at your trend line and also your real dollars graph, looks like that's where oil should be if the supply and demand forces were normal compared to what they were historically.
The problem, of course, is it's a dynamic that where the base changes, so that, you know, if the demand for oil, OPEC oil, went to 27 million barrels, and the Iraq came into the market at the same time, and we were sitting at $12 oil, it would have a little different effect on the market. But yeah, it could happen. I would say that the Merrill Lynch are the bulls right now. As far as oil price forecasting, I was looking at their most recent projection for WTI. They believe WTI is going to be back up at 20 very soon, like within the next two quarters. But I would say that is from the forecasts that we look at, that they're the bulls.
That's the highest forecast is
that I know of right now is the Merrill Lynch forecast, right? And I hope I haven't misconstrued their number, but I believe it is $20 WTI by the third quarter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have Representative Terrio.
Yeah, I just had a quick question on the effect of production, not so much price. In your projection last year, you had Point McIntyre coming online.
Yes.
That was figured in. But last year, when I was up on the slope, they said they were not able to put as much oil through the line because of the warm weather and the effect on efficiency of machinery. How much did that impact what was actually brought in, or was it fairly insignificant?
Okay. The sort of a two-part answer. First of all, the construction activity and the warmer than normal weather, and I assume that this construction activity was mostly associated with the gas handling expansion, reduced production a lot more than not only we had thought, but I believe also the industry themselves. I believe Valieska had planned on making a little more oil this year than they ultimately did, and a lot of it was because of those two the factors that you suggested. We were conservative about Point McIntyre. I believe they're producing at about 100 to 110,000 barrels a day right now. When we did the forecast, we used, I think, 50,000 a day for startup. But they went up to over 100,000 barrels a day very quickly. So we got a little extra oil there. But it just to summarize again what I said earlier, barring technical disruptions, with Point Mac kicking out, and right now they're the real constraint with Point McIntyre and with Nyaka coming on is the Lisburn facility has the capacity to process so much crude oil. If they maybe can debottleneck that, we might even see more oil coming out. But we expect 95 to be a better year than 94. We expect to move more oil down the pipeline than we did last year.
By estimating Point McIntyre, conservatively, did that offset the lost production due to the weather? Was it pretty much a wash?
Well, the trouble is, you know, we're forecasting a cash flow for a fixed number of months, and you know, we miss if we missed for 3 or 4 months, it takes more to offset that so that the annual average makes up. And we're gonna be below what we thought. I think I'd have to take another look, but we're gonna be, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of, I think we were using last spring 1.7. I think we're probably gonna come in at 1.65.
So now, in looking at the effect of weather on demand, do you also have to look at the effect of weather on production, our production too?
I've asked the folks that in my shop that are responsible for doing the forecast to try a little harder to adjust the summer production with some seasonal factors. I think a lot of what went on last year, however, were construction related things. So weather was warmer than normal, but there were also extended shutdowns for certain construction activities that really weren't anticipated.
Senator,
that may happen again. That's true. It could.
Thank you. Senator Cotulla?
I understand congressional nightmare for our delegation, certainly Ted Stevens. And I don't know if it's discussed at the cabinet level, but it ought to be is the massive subsidy that's moving on to the majors to develop and help and assist in developing the Russian fields, about $20 billion, which means that's going to affect prices 3, 5, or 7 years. That's something that I don't think is the best interest of Western development, and I don't understand it. I would think the cabinet and the governor would involve themselves in that concern. I hear it coming out of D.C. now. And I know Senator Stevens is very much on top of it and very concerned about it, although I only know that secondhand, not firsthand. Further, Point McIntyre, yet through a miserable and an error in decision by the Commissioner of Natural Resources, is going to be in a substantial legal battle with Exxon, and that may well affect the returns on at least royalty that we're going to receive. And you've got to factor that in at some stage. I'm very, very distressed with that decision. We'll get into it later in a number of legislative inquiries, but that means the income may not be what you may be projecting, and at least the royalty portion. That's just my own opinion. But
well, Senator, that's a good point, and I should stress that we are forecasting the revenues from Point Mac under the state's position. That is, that there is no allowance for processing deduction like Prudhoe Bay. They're not in the unit, basically.
That negotiation should have resolved itself, not your fault nor the commissioner's, but that should have resolved itself before we went to production. Exxon is gained a miserable advantage, I fear, by going to production in that. And particularly when there's no need for the product to, one, keep the pipeline alive, or we're not getting money out of it to speak of anyway, no income. I'm really sensitive to what happened there. Thank you.
I had a couple questions. Chuck, could you refresh our memory or enlighten us further on worldwide production? We talked about OPEC production, and I think, you know, there's some figures there to show us what that is. But refresh our memory on worldwide production, and then how much excess production there is relative to consumption, and then explain more about how the Iraq situation relates to worldwide production, OPEC production, and you know, how big a deal is it if if Iraq comes back into the market in a major way. Seems like that would really mess things up, but could you review all that for us?
Yes, okay. On the handout, there isn't. I gave you the narrative instead of the numbers on worldwide production.
I didn't bring anything.
Well, I've got it here. Worldwide production, you know, there's a seasonal component. It's let's see what we get here. Here we go. Okay, worldwide production probably averages right now, it's going to, for 93, worldwide production is going to average something around 65 million barrels a day. Okay, we used, actually, let's call it 60, I think 66.1 is the number that we used in the fall forecast for 93. That was based on, you know, it's, unfortunately, these numbers are a guess. I mean, 2 years from now, I could tell you with certainty how much oil was produced, but that's not going to help us today. But about 66 a million barrels a day, which I guess if we assumed OPEC's at 24/7, they're producing about 35% of the world's oil. But most importantly, most of what they produce, they export. Okay, so they're the ones that are creating. They're the ones that we go to after we produced all our own oil. We go to them to get whatever additional oil we need, and that's why we focus on how much oil OPEC is going to need to produce, because that they really are. They're the people that fill the market with the barrels that the people can't produce themselves. I think, depending on what you want to assume about global economic growth, we usually say that energy requirement and oil requirement in particular is going to grow at a rate of about 1 to 3. In other words, for every 3% growth in the world economy, you're going to need about 1% more oil. Now, this is not a really good ratio for short run forecasting. I can tell you, even this will vary widely, but it's something that people have used for some time. It's more of a long term type relationship. Okay, now as far as like where does Iraq fit into this picture?
How much excess capacity there is right now?
Yes.
You kind of gave the impression that just a very small excess production could result in a very large swing in price, and
right.
So I'm trying to understand.
Okay. Okay. The interesting thing about oil is that there's what economists call a stock flow sort of phenomena, which means that you have to look at how much oil is coming out of the ground, but also how much oil have people stored above the ground. And so you can watch the behavior of storage. That's usually, the behavior of storage is something that the people that play the, quote, play the market look at a lot. And I can tell you it's a very confusing thing. It's depending on circumstances, changes in inventory can mean either higher or lower prices. It all depends on whether you're stocking up because the price is low, or you're destocking because you are facing a real surge in demand. So, you know, does that mean the prices are high or low? It's not unambiguous, but I think the easiest way to put it, and you see I've seen a number of attempts. We get a couple of publications where people try to identify what the production consumption gap is. The numbers that I've seen are that adjusting for seasonal factors and everything, there may be as little as an additional 100,000 to 200,000 barrels a day on the market. That may be the range. That's why the pundits all were telling OPEC when they met in November, hey, just cut a couple 100,000 barrels a day and you'll stabilize the market. But I'm telling you, I wouldn't put a lot of faith in these numbers. It's still a one of these kind of assessments, because you really don't know the numbers. I mean, there's a lot of people spend a lot of time trying to track the barrels. You know, they're tracking the tankers, trying to determine how full the tankers are, where they're going, and all that. And a lot of people spend a lot of time doing that. But I don't know if the number is 200,000 barrels a day or a million barrels a day, quite frankly. But the numbers that we get and that are updated on a monthly basis continue to suggest that it's not a big number, that there's not a lot of extra oil. But there's oil out there. And as long as there's oil out there, and probably a little bit more than you need, that keeps a lid, which leads to the second factor that you mentioned about Iraq. I believe that is a real weight on the market, and it's gotten into the minds of the people that buy and sell crude oil today or for future delivery, and they worry about that. And it's almost like an insurance premium that you have to take out of the price of oil, because it's this fear that Iraq could come back into the market. And Iraq has complied with most of the checklist of things that they have to do to have what's called a partial removal of the embargo. That is, remove the embargo enough so that they can sell enough oil to make 1.7 billion, I think it is. And then that 1.7 billion, it doesn't really go to Iraq for distribution or for spending. It goes to the UN, and then the UN doles it out to Iraq in the form of aid, medicine, and that. Iraq is apparently not actually totally agreed on the border, the demarcation of the border between themselves and Kuwait. That's one thing I believe that they have not agreed to. But the other thing is that Iraq doesn't want this partial lifting. They want a total lifting of the embargo. And that's been a negotiating posture they've taken with the UN. Now, the UN, in general, would like to lift the embargo. They need the $1.7 billion to fund their activities in Iraq, because they're also taking care of peacekeepers in Somalia and wherever else the UN is involved in Bosnia and all that. But which is why the market has the pundits have come up with this $2 risk premium. Now, if Iraq did come online, how much could they produce, and how much could they export? Well, the pundits say, well, it would take them at least 12 months to gear up, which means that in reality it would probably take them about a month. I mean, because the pundits, for reasons I don't understand, always seem to underestimate the ability of people to sell oil for money when they need it real badly. And secondly, the pundits also say, well, Iraq was producing at 3 million barrels a day before the war, but nah, their infrastructure is still in a shambles from the war, and the Shatt al-Arab's probably still got a bunch of mines and all that kind of stuff. Well, maybe they could move 1.6 million a day, mostly through the pipeline that goes through Turkey. That's probably a reasonable estimate. So, you know, maybe they could get a million to a million and a half barrels a day onto the market within 3 or 4 months. That would be just a wild guess by me, but I think it's somewhat consistent with the numbers you see thrown around. Well, an additional 1.5 to 1.6 million barrels a day in today's $10 oil market, you're right, could be absolutely devastating, which is why OPEC, the one step they need to take, which, to my way of thinking, is sort of a strategic plan that doesn't necessarily involve any barrels, is that if they could just come up with a credible plan and all endorse it and make sure that everyone knew about it, I think that would go a long way towards getting rid of this $2 discount, as it were.
Who filled the void that Iraq left in the market when it quit producing? Was it non-OPEC or OPEC?
Mr. Chairman, it was almost entirely Saudi Arabia. They kicked up from 5.5 million barrels a day to 8.5, and well, they're down to 8 right now. Okay. So that's why most of the members of OPEC, when this issue of some, hey, we got to get barrels off the market, they all go, King Fahd, please take some of your barrels off the market.
And well, it seems like, you know, if what you say about the price, being influenced by small reductions, it seems like it'd be obvious. Well, take a couple hundred thousand off the market, and make the price go back up, and they'd be wildly better off. I mean, I didn't realize that there was that it could be changed that much by a few hundred thousand barrels or even a million.
I believe that it could. I think the markets that it's.
Why don't they do it?
Given this, that is a good question. I mean, it revolves around a great deal of intransigence by the Saudis, and we will not be the swing producer, period. We will never again be the swing producer. If we cut, everyone else has to cut. And if everyone else doesn't cut, we won't cut. So they're in a standoff. We'll see what happens by March. That's our next milestone, really.
Okay, I have Representative Hoffman and then Representative Martin.
On that point, going back to OPEC's total production, on page 9 you say that the latest figures we have are in November, and you said that the production is somewhere around 24.7 million barrels a day. How far in the future does OPEC predict their quotas, and what are they?
Well, let's see. I don't think I didn't hand that out. In our fall forecast, I have we do have the quotas. Okay. The first part of your question, the quotas are in place until they're changed. And generally that means that they have official meetings every roughly six months. And every time they sit down and have a meeting, the quotas are on the table, basically. So about every 6 months would be one way of saying it. As far as the individual countries, quotas, right now, Saudi Arabia's quota is 8 million a day. The United Arab Emirates, 2.16. Venezuela, 2.3. Nigeria, 1.865. Qatar, 378. This is in 1,000 barrels a day. Libya, 1390. Kuwait, 2 million a day. Iraq. Well, now they say they have a quota. I'm not sure they do. I guess they do plug in a number. Right now they're plugging in 400,000 barrels a day for Iraq. I guess what that's recognizing is that Iraq is theoretically producing 400,000 barrels a day for internal use. As a matter of fact, Iraq is probably exporting an extra 300 to 400,000 barrels a day through Jordan and through Iran.
But going back to 1992, all the way through the first quarter of 93, their quotas changed every 3 months. Is it possible that they may go in and have a, what happened there? Did they have special meetings to change those quotas? And what's the possibility of having them come in and change their quotas before March?
At this standing today, looking at it, I would say it looks pretty, the chances look fairly slim. But who knows? Generally speaking, there doesn't seem to be a strong. Let me put it this way: if the oil minister from Saudi Arabia became serious about dealing with the price situation and announced to his other, you know, informally to the other ministers that maybe they ought to do something, or if the Gulf Cooperation Council or one of the other political bodies that deals with regional issues amongst the Arab OPEC producers, if they informally got together, it might happen. However, with an official meeting already set up for the end of March, my guess is they'd probably stick to that schedule.
And the Gulf producers did have that meeting back in December, and they decided that if everyone would cut, that they would cut,
including non-OPEC.
They were asking
for cooperation.
So that was just in December. So it's very unlikely that they would until March.
Representative Martin.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I want to make a couple statements and then get it back to Alaska, and especially ask Chuck and the Commissioner what looks good for Alaska. No matter what we talk about in world production and world prices, we have to take care of ourselves, and no matter what, I just said we're going to generally decrease by 5% per year unless we do something. And as I make a couple of statements, I'm going to ask if you would think about what looks good in Alaska's future. Where are there new leases at new hopes? What can we do for incentives to discoveries? Because it seems to me throughout the world, especially in Russia and in China and even in Laos, that American companies are finding it better to go to world markets, like recently in Colombia, 187,000 acre field up for bid, and a Denver firm won it for discoveries. And they're not looking for exploration just to sit on it. They want to get it produced. And when we talk about a small spurt in the market, Laos went from 30,000 barrels producing locally to 120,000 barrels in the same area in 1 year. They never expected. So therefore, it's less import there, less export someplace else, which means 100,000 has to be made up. The Russian production is definitely going to go up. We've got Alaskan firms as well as Denver firms over there contracting, and Chevron and others really wanting to produce. So that means more is going to come on. So I feel we have to get away from those points of view to saying, hey, what can we do for ourselves? We just can't depend on all the other countries producing or whatever. Is there any hope for Alaska besides wait and worry at the other markets? Any leases coming on? Any incentives to encourage industries to discover and produce more for us?
Let me try to address the question, although I think the Department of Natural Resources is probably has a better handle on what the current policies that are being implemented. I know there's something called area-wide leasing that was pursued last year, but I think that that to a certain extent, you know, we were in a little bit of an unfortunate situation, because I think there was a considerable amount of excitement about Alaska as a province to explore and develop oil when, you know, Kuvlum was announced and Sunfish, and I think there was sort of a psychological uptick in the interest in exploration money coming back to Alaska. With the announcements that those things were not proven to be commercial, that is somewhat of a handicap, just in terms of you know, the cachet of going to Alaska instead of Russia. So I mean, we face it that those announcements were not helpful in doing that. As far as what can we do? Well, to a large extent, I think, you know, we've been going down we've had a track record of leasing, of lease sales. You know, we have to fight all the battles that are associated with the institutional development of the environmental movement and the trade-offs between development and doing it in a way that is environmentally sound, which those things all affect costs. And it's just we're a part of the United States, and that's where we are. We have and continue to have as attractive a tax environment as anywhere else in the world. We did in the international tax study that we did several years ago, it was clear that there were some things we could do in making our system a bit more profit sensitive. But in general, the oil fields, at least the ones that we looked at and the exploration possibilities that we looked at, suggested that although the development costs in the United States are probably a little higher because we can afford to require the companies to take a little better care of the environment when they produce it, the bottom line is on the incremental dollar in the United States, a company gets 50 cents. That's the bottom line. I mean, that's the after. Well, yeah, it's about that. And that Alaska and the federal government split the other 50 cents. Now, that's after development costs. That's after costs. That's of the pure rent. That's just taking the incremental tax rates. So I don't know that we could do necessarily a lot on that side. I think, but you need to probably address that question to the Department of Natural Resources, because they may have some things like credits or direct subsidization that they might want to that they may be looking at. I don't know.
Are there any other questions?
Dr. Loxton, I'd like to know what type of impact the Alaska pipeline will have with the non-compliance of the pipeline. What type of impact will it have on our royalties and our tariffs? Because they have to do extensive work on the pipeline.
Senator, at this point, if we knew exactly what the costs, what the cost number we were looking at, and the extent to which those costs can be put into the tariff, I could probably have a better answer for you. At this point, I don't have any real good numbers, but I can tell you that every dollar that the costs of the pipeline go up, we pay 25 cents of that dollar. So we have a very direct interest in how much Alaska's cost base goes up. And I think just from the perspective of the state, we need to be sure that the costs that are included are legitimate, that it's not a cost shift of you know, overhead from the home office shifted into the Alaska cost base or those kinds of things. I mean, and I think that's something that the Attorney General is very that the Department of Law is looking at very, very closely with respect to some of these spill expenses it's something that I think we need to be vigilant about, because we're paying 25 cents of every dollar that it costs to operate and run the pipeline.
Are you taking that into consideration for the production level too?
Yes, to a certain extent. To the extent we can, to the extent we have good numbers. I mean, we're going right now with we don't have the 94 filing totally updated into our our projections. We'll be doing that in the spring forecast. But yes, we're trying to. It's just a matter of getting the numbers as they become available, and it does affect the production stream. And you know, if the theory of the pipeline settlement agreement was that we would allow the owners to recover the costs up front, that we would allow very high tariffs early on, so that the capital part of the rate base would go away very quickly, and we'd have low tariffs in the 90s. And so far, that's kept the tariff in the $3 a barrel range, and hopefully that will happen. When I guess the longer you go out in time, the more you need to be concerned about how many barrels are carrying the operating costs of the line, because that's really what's going to drive the cost of moving oil off the pipeline. So, yeah, we need to. That's something we always need to think about. I think it's, however, somewhat more of a long-term problem as far as field development. We're probably okay through the 90s as far as that relationship.
But it'll have a negative impact.
Yes, it will. Yes, it will. Ultimately, it will.
Finished? Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? We do have a report that I asked Mike Greeney to prepare for us on the rule of thumb. You know, we always hear about the $130 to $150 million rule of thumb for any change of by $1 in the price of oil, and the minimum severance tax and the zero royalty point. And he produced a sheet that shows those something on those, and I think you have it before you. And I'd like Mike to join you folks, if he's here, to just run us through this so that we do have an understanding of you know, how relevant that rule of thumb is, over what range it's relevant, and then talk about the, just to refresh our memories on the minimum severance tax point and the zero royalty point, including the transportation charge. So go ahead, Mike or Chuck or whoever wants to lead off on that.
Mr. Chairman, Mike Greeney, Legislative Finance. There's been a lot of interest recently because of oil has been so low. It's been so far below the normal the range, the 15 to 18 that Chuck has talked about earlier, that Chuck and I got together over the phone and put together some rough numbers on the behavior of oil in the low range. And just for the record here, I'd like to touch the three main points and then say that Chuck is the expert on this, and if there's any questions, I think they'd best be directed to him. But looking at $10 per barrel being approximately the crossover point as we talk about the three points here, the new low range rule of thumb, instead of the 135 to 140 million per barrel unrestricted that we'd get per dollar, when you cross below $10, that rule of thumb would be $75 million per barrel. I mean, I guess the good news is the lower price goes, the less we lose. It also means the less we get. That $10 crossover point, keeping in mind that the two major sources of our revenues are severance tax and royalty, on the severance side, we're down to, when we go below $10 per barrel, I think Chuck was probably talking in the $9.50 to $10 range, probably closer to $10, that we're down to the minimum severance tax of 74 cents per barrel. Then on royalty, going back to a discussion of what point are we getting zero royalty out of ANS, roughly that price would be at $5.45 per barrel. And the way that Chuck came up with that number, there are three major costs. One, the field costs, which are basically the lifting and gathering costs to the point of getting it into the pipeline. That's estimated at 70 cents per barrel. The transportation costs through the pipeline, the tariff is just now going to 3.25 a barrel. And then the tankerage costs from Valdez down to the coast, West Coast, and wherever else it's going is a buck and a half per barrel. And that's how we arrive at the $5.45 per barrel. Then the rest of the handout was just to give the historical perspective on a yearly basis what the prices have been averaging.
Thank you. Representative Brown.
Thank you. In your first bullet, new low-range rule of thumb, are you referring to market destination sales prices being below 10 or netback prices? What prices are you referencing?
Chuck, I believe it would be the usual average lower 48.
Market price.
Market price between the West Coast and Gulf Coast with, again, it's over 80% now of the oil going to the West Coast, so any weighting is in favor of the West Coast.
So we're not actually, sales prices are not below 10.
Today, they're not, but if they were to get down there, I mean, as was mentioned earlier, there was a point where they did dip below that crossover point, at least on the West Coast.
Seems like they would be, if you want to be accurate, you'd be looking at this, separate markets, because, and you would have, obviously, to the Gulf Coast, you would have a greater transportation cost than to the West Coast, I would assume, and that you shouldn't look at it as a weighted average. Well, really, if you want to talk about this, you should talk about the separate markets. Senator Pierce and then Representative Martin.
I have a tankerage question. Does the tankerage cost get audited and or approved by FERC or APUC the way the pipeline tariff does? Or do they just say, and by the way, it cost us so much to get this barrel of oil?
The tanker cost is actually a major part of the oil and gas audit division's audit program. And there are some very specific accounting rules laid out in regulation about what's allowed and what's not, and it's subject to the state's audit, which has resulted, at least to a certain extent, in some of the collections from prior years and the settlements that we've achieved through that process.
Do we know ahead of time what the companies plan to charge for, let's say, any changes, new costs associated with OPA 90? Do we know that so that you can plug that into your projections ahead, or do we just have to wait?
Senator, yeah, we project the cash flow, so we use the numbers that the companies file with us, and they file every month. So to the extent that those cost increases from Open IND begin showing up, we know what they're reporting. We don't know ultimately whether or not that number will stand after audit, but for projection purposes, we're using what the companies are claiming on their tax returns. I should point out that there's an important distinction between the severance tax revenues implied and the royalties, because we have a formula basis for establishing the transportation cost deduction for our royalties taken from both ARCO and Exxon. And the Exxon number is, they get $1.25. That's what they have, that's what they are allowed for their West Coast sales, and that's subject to an escalation factor that kicks in, I believe, in 96 or 97. ARCO actually receives a transportation allowance, which is a fixed percentage of the value of the royalty market basket, which is used for assessing the West Coast price of oil. Interestingly, that gives us some good, another, that's not a, it's not often mentioned, but that gives us quite a bit of a buffer. When oil prices are low, the allowance for transportation gets low because it's a fixed percentage of a lower number. I think it's about 3.5% is what they're allowed. So 3.5% of $10 is a lot lower than 3.5% of $20. So to a certain extent, for ARCO royalties anyway, that's another buffer that we haven't put into the mix. But the point is, there is a difference between what we allow for transportation on the severance tax side and what's allowed on the royalty side, which is a direct function of the royalty settlements that were cut with the majors over the last couple of years.
Representative Martin.
Yeah, thanks, Senator. At the point I'm going to get into, Chuck and Mike, if we can, what does it amount to Alaska per day? Now, if we're taking at the wellhead value, say today at $10, and your cost is 545, then let's say 1045, then that means we get a value, or the total market is $5. We get 27% of that, severance and royalty, generally speaking. Get 27% of whatever the wellhead value is.
Representative, actually, when the price gets below that crossover, our percentage actually goes up because we're floored in at 80 cents no matter what the price. So 80 cents is a larger percentage of $3 than it is of $5. So actually, our percentage take increases. That's the good news. The bad news is we get a bigger slice of pie, but our pie is a lot smaller.
So can we say today, if we're at 1045, what the market price was this morning, and you take off your cost at 545, you're playing with a $5 fee to work with either ICO or ourselves, the state. Then we multiply that, say one-fourth of that 25% would be $1.25 times, we'll say, production 1.7 million. That's how we can get our annual daily income.
That's close.
Generally.
That's close. Yeah. The 25% includes the permanent fund contribution to the...
Right, sure. Right,
on the royalty side, so it's probably
available for
it's a little less than that. But that would be a way of doing it, yes.
Any other questions? Not? Thank you very much. Very informative, and we appreciate you coming. Adjourned.